Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Samuel Scroggins. He's an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Virginia. Sam, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Glad to be here.
Awesome. Well, good. First question for you is if you can just give us a brief kind of history of your training and your current practice setup.
I originally did undergraduate at BYU. I went to dental school at University of Alabama in Birmingham. I actually practiced as a general dentist for about 3 years in Birmingham after finishing dental school. And I was kind of trying to decide exactly what path I wanted to follow. And then I did a 1 year internship at Medical College of Georgia, or whatever it's called now. It's changed names over the year. It's like Augusta Health, or, but anyway. And then I did residency training at University of Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson, Mississippi. And then after residency, I moved to Virginia. I was with a practice up in kind of Shenandoah Valley area, Virginia, for about a year. And then I came down and purchased my current practice from an older doctor. And I'm in the Roanoke, Virginia area. I've been there for about 10 years now, a little over 10 years.
That's fantastic. All right. And I recently kind of read an Amos Today article and came upon some of the stuff you're doing that was called high pointing in every U.S. state. This is in the most, or Amos Today article. So can you tell us a little bit about high pointing and kind of how you got into this?
So how it all started was, it's been about 7-8 years ago. I kind of tell the story at the time. I'd purchased the practice. I'd kind of gotten things up to a little better production, kind of stable level than it was when I first purchased it. We had been here in Roanoke for a few years. And then we had also just finished building a house. So we'd kind of gone through a lot of changes. And I guess felt like life was fairly stable at the time. And so we were trying to figure out what to do next. You know, if for anyone that's gone through residency, you can appreciate that you're spending most of your time in residency just trying to focus on getting done and where you're going to get a job afterwards and finding a place to live. And then once you've done that, then you kind of look around and be like, okay, what am I going to do other than just daily practice with the rest of my life? So we had some friends over, and the wife, she's working on hiking the Appalachian Trail. And she's doing it in sections, just because her schedule and family doesn't really allow her to take off 6 months and go do it. But she'll take like a week and do a, you know, 100-mile section of it, and then take another week 6 months later and do another section of it. So anyway, we were talking about that, and I was like, that sounds fun. I really like to hike, but I don't like to sleep on the ground. I don't like the idea of not sleeping in a bed for extended periods of time. So we were talking about, I was like, I could do hiking, but I don't know if I feel like just sleeping out in the woods all the time. So then I just kind of came off the idea of like, I could do like the highest point in all 50 states. And so I just kind of threw this out there, and my wife liked the idea. And then we started looking into it. And I guess it is something that people have done. You know, there's like even a club, the High Pointers Club, where people go around and try to go to the highest point in all 50 states. And so that was kind of how it started. We found out some more information about it and then just started looking at opportunities to do this.
Wow, that is cool. And so how many peaks have you climbed so far?
We've done 36. You know, it's kind of interesting you say climbed, and some of them definitely are climbs or more significant hikes. Some of them are like essentially stopping in a park and walking along a path and you're there. I mean, like Florida, we did that many years ago. And realistically, we went on a trip to the Gulf Coast just to go to the beach. And then on the way home, just stopped. And it's basically like a park that you just stop at in the Florida Panhandle and you walk like 50 feet and there's a little sign that says the highest point in Florida. So some of these are really just more kind of trips to go to, you know, just places to stop at. And some of them are places where we actually plan a more involved trip and have to plan out for the hiking and the equipment we need and stuff like that.
Got it. Okay. Because I would imagine, I don't even know where the highest point in the United States is. Is it in the Rocky Mountains or where?
The highest point in the continental United States is Mount Whitney in California. The highest point in the United States is Denali in Alaska, formerly known as Mount McKinley. But that's the highest point in the United States. But yeah, the highest point in the continental U.S. is in the Sierras, Mount Whitney. It's about, it's not much different. It's like 100 feet higher than the highest point in Colorado. But yeah, we did that. We did Mount Whitney this last fall, last October.
Nice. Okay. And which was the Colorado peak you went to?
Highest point in Colorado is Mount Elbert. It's like 14,000, I think it's almost 400 feet. It's really like 100 feet lower than Mount Whitney, so it's not hugely different. But it's close to Leadville, Colorado. And we did that one. That was one we did years ago. That was, I don't know, that was 6 or 7 years ago. That was probably the first Western peak that we did.
Is it usually just you and your wife, or is it your whole family going?
It just depends. I mean, a lot of times if it's, you know, reasonably smaller hikes, it'll be the whole family. But we've done combinations of all of them. We've done the whole family, and on some of them we've done select kids that wanted to go on it. And some of them it's just been my wife and I. And some of the ones that even aren't that hard, my wife and I will do it and we'll just kind of get away for a trip. Like this last summer, we went to some of the ones in the upper Midwest, and they're really not that hard. It's like Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin. None of them are really that hard as far as hikes, but we just, you know, kind of had to check them off the list. So we took a few days, and it was kind of a fun little getaway. One of the other kind of side benefits of this is it allows you to see areas of the country and just experience areas that you never otherwise would go to. Probably 5 years ago, we did the highest point in Texas, which is actually, I think, higher than most people would recognize. It's in the far western edge of Texas, that little skinny part that sits below New Mexico. And it's about 8,700 feet. And to do it, we flew into El Paso, and it's about an hour outside of El Paso. But it was interesting because it's a place I'd never been, really, to that part of Texas. And it's probably not a place that ever really had any particular reason to go to otherwise, but it just allows you to see cities and parts of the country that you otherwise wouldn't, and kind of experience, you know, a broad range of the country.
And I like how in the article, Amos Today, it shows the, you know, the map of the United States and your picture where you're gone, and each picture you're giving your wife a kiss, it looks like at the peak. So it looks like it's something that is potentially, you know, strengthening your marriage relationship. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. It's a common goal, you know, and a lot of things, you know, obviously you have your children and you have other things you're working on, but this is just kind of a common goal that we've developed for ourselves. And so it is good to have, I think that's a good thing to have. And I've told people that before, because it allows you to grow and do something together. Because a lot of times if you do have maybe different interests or different hobbies, then as you have more means and more free time, you start to develop those different interests and hobbies, and you can end up kind of doing your own separate thing. This is okay to everyone, you know, has their own interest, and you should, you know, kind of build your own abilities and things like that. But I think it's good to, you know, do that as a couple, do something like this as a couple, have some sort of goal or project that you're working on together to help provide unity. But as you alluded to, that's like one of our rules. To count as a high point, we just have to be at the top together, and we have to kiss at the top.
Oh, very cool. What's your next peak you're working on getting to?
The next one we're planning on is Mount Hood in Oregon. Then we got We're planning on doing that in June of this year. And then we have a few others that, because some of them like that, we have to plan on because it's bigger and, you know, we have to fly across the country. And then we still have a few left in the East. Actually, I take that back. I guess the next one we're looking at doing is Ohio, which isn't very tall. We're going to go up there on the total eclipse is like in a month. It's like the total eclipse that's running from Texas up through the Midwest, up to the Northeast. Anyway, so we're going to go up to Ohio to be in the zone of totality of the total eclipse. And the highest point in Ohio is also right there in the middle of the zone of totality. So we were going to do that while we were there. I mean, it's one of those, it's not hard. It's really like, it's actually on this campus of this local community college, but you just drive up and you walk, you know, I don't know, a quarter mile and you're at the top. But, you know, we were just going to combine it with our trip to go see the total solar eclipse. So that's actually, I guess, the next one we're doing. But the next big one is Mount Hood.
That'll be a fun trip. That's great. And you have how many children?
I have eight children.
Eight children. Okay. You're the first guest on the podcast to have more kids than me. This is impressive. You know, I tell people it's no joke having six kids. It's just so much work and time consuming and, you know, challenging sometimes to have alone time with your wife and connect when you're being pulled in all different directions. What are your one power tip for getting through residency? Because I'm guessing you had some of your kids during residency. We've had a couple of podcasts where we talked about trying to get through residency with kids and a family because it's no easy task. How did you do it?
I'll start by saying my wife was really good. She was really supportive in this. And actually, she was largely, because after, as I mentioned, after dental school, I was working as a general dentist, and I was kind of deciding if this was something I wanted to do, and if it was worth the time and the effort and the commitment. And she was really encouraging. She kind of recognized that this was something that I would like to do, and that I would ultimately be more fulfilled long term doing this than staying in general dentistry. And so she really encouraged me to do it. So that's, I guess, the first thing is she was very supportive and understood going into it what it would involve. I think that's part of it is, you know, to be honest and have that discussion, you know, with your spouse and as a family going into something like that and honestly what it's going to involve and what the hours are going to be. The other thing I would say is when you're in residency, you want to, you know, be committed to working hard while you're at the hospital, at your, you know, program. But it's also easy sometimes, I know, thinking back to residency, you know, you're there and there's certain stuff you got to get done. But then sometimes you're done with everything you really have to do. And everyone just kind of sitting around and you chat and you're just kind of, you know, goofing off in the resident room or whatever like that. And there's a certain point at which you do need to recognize like, okay, this is the time that I need to commit to my training, to be a good resident, to learn what I need to take care of my responsibilities, carry my weight, try to schedule where possible within the, you know, limited time available in residency, you know, time for your family, not just end up spending dead time, you know, at the hospital, hanging out with the other residents when you don't really need to, when you're not really accomplishing anything useful. And the other thing I would say is when you are home, try to be actively engaged in being at home with your family. You know, obviously you may need to be doing reading for upcoming cases, you know, preparing, you know, different things like that, but try not to be just goofing off on your phone or doing other, you know, pointless things just because you do have limited time with your family and you want to try to make the time you have more significant.
I like that. So kind of time management, and that's how I felt too. I had to be pretty dedicated with saying, okay, I gotta get this and this done. And as soon as I'm done, I'm going home. And once I'm home, being present, once I'm there, helping out and all that type of stuff. And I liked what you're talking about, how going into it, you kind of have to make sure you're both on the same page and both know what you're getting into and stuff like that. I mean, I think even going into it and, you know, telling your wife, oh, it's going to be X amount of hours and it's going to be really hard. I think even that is oftentimes it's, once you get into it, you're like, whoa, this is way more than we thought it was going to be. It's hard to prepare a spouse for how grueling it is. And sometimes certain residencies are kind of caustic and it's taking a toll on your mental status and all that stuff. So got to have good communication too, and involving your spouse and letting her or him know what's going on, that type of stuff. And then what's the power tip on parenting? I mean, it looks like you're raising eight amazing children. So
like I said, my wife's really good at that too. And that maybe we just got lucky that we're each do fairly well at our roles. But I would say give responsibility to your older children, you know, because ultimately, I mean, people think about, you know, having children, it doesn't necessarily get, you know, it's not like it multiplies each time the difficulty. You know, it's not like having six children is six times necessarily, you know, more difficult than having one child, but they are each different. But then as you can, you know, start giving responsibility to your older children, whether that's responsibility for things around the house, responsibility for the younger children, you know, where possible, and recognize that a lot of times things aren't going to go right the first time you give them a job and the first time you tell them to do something. And you have to decide, you know, what things you're okay with not being perfect and just kind of them figuring out as they go. The other thing I would say is just, you know, make your children do hard things. That's part of the hiking thing, some of this stuff we do is, if your children know and have experiences doing things that are really hard and are very uncomfortable for them, it really helps them as they move forward in life and they encounter situations that they're very uncomfortable in. You know, and we've done that with a lot of our outdoor stuff. Like I said, with hiking, we like to ski. With skiing, I try to push the kids to, you know, I'm like, well, yeah, that's steep, but, you know, the worst thing that can happen is you fall down and you get up. And, you know, kind of the idea is to do things that you're uncomfortable with. And I was listening to this book podcast by a guy, David Goggins. He's this Navy SEAL that's done tons of ultra marathons and stuff. But he was talking about the idea of embracing discomfort. And obviously there's kind of balance there, especially with children. But the idea of, I think that's good, especially in today's society where, you know, parents often worry about trying to pave the road for their children and helping, making sure that they have a path to success. I think helping your children embrace discomfort is good for their long-term character and probably mental health.
Hey guys, real quick, KLS Martin is offering a 35% discount on my favorite KLS Martin instruments for everyday oral surgery listeners. So there's a link in the podcast notes with a full listing and a video highlighting some of the advantages of using KLS Martin instrumentation. To utilize this offer, use promo code STUCKYFAVES with a capital S and a capital F. So capital S, lowercase T-U-C-K-I, capital F, lowercase A-V-S. And you can use that through your KLS Martin sales rep or by emailing usa@klsmartin.com. I handpicked these instruments based on the kind of favorite extraction instruments that I use on a daily basis, and I hope you enjoy them. I agree 100%. And I think this is no easy task, especially for the oral and maxillofacial surgeon who, you know, usually most of us make a pretty good living and live in nice communities. And sometimes I feel like the affluence and the abundance can almost be its own trial and, you know, be a disservice to your children if you're not kind of helping them experience hard things so that later in life, like you're saying, when they get through trials, you know, they can stick to it and make it through the difficulty. But yeah, I mean, I think that's all really helpful. Sure, you have your kids in sports. You know, we do sports and music lessons, and half the time they're whining about it, complaining, I don't want to go, this is too hard, you know, I don't get playing time, I'm on the bench and all this stuff. That's the moment as parents where we have to be like, nope, you know, you signed up, you're going to stick it out. And there's something, you know, about commitment, and I'll teach them all these, you know, principles of life that they gotta. Sometimes I'll tell you there's moments of weakness when you have six kids complaining and you're just like, just make it stop, and you want to break. But that's when you got to dig deep and pull out that residency version of yourself and just keep on pushing through.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, there are times that, I mean, obviously, yeah, I mean, it's definitely chaotic. I mean, the other thing I would say with that is make sure that you do have time that you schedule with just your spouse. My wife and I try to go out most Saturdays, just go out to dinner. And you know, it's important to schedule, you know, trips. You know, I think it's good to go on small little trips a few times a year, or just you and your spouse, you know, just to kind of have that balance in your family. And I think that's good for the children too. I think that's really good for your children to see, you know, kind of the order there, that the world doesn't revolve around them. And that because then hopefully as they get older and look at, you know, dating and finding somebody to potentially marry, they kind of recognize that same balance.
Another question I have for you is if you can just kind of give us some of your maybe experience and tips on kind of growing an OMFS practice in a smaller community. What are your thoughts on that?
So I'll kind of tell you about my practice. Right now, it's just I'm the only doctor in the practice, although I am working on trying to bring in an associate, have been for the last couple of years, just because we are growing and we built a new office about 3 years ago. But that is also one of the challenges is, you know, sometimes getting people to move to a small, you know, kind of medium-sized city can be a little more challenging because most residents want to, and some of that's due to their, you know, family situation. Some of us do just to kind of, especially when you're young and you get out of residency, you know, you like the idea of being in a big city where there's lots to do and lots of exciting things. But for myself, when I came down and purchased this practice about 10 years ago, it was an older doctor that was having some health concerns and was having to retire earlier than anticipated. And it was an older practice. It was an older office. You know, one of the things I would say is you're starting a practice or buying an older practice, you have to figure out if it's an area that you're happy being in. And then, you know, there's always going to be some compromises early on. You're not going to have all the nicest stuff that you'd like, may not have the nicest waiting room, the, you know, the nicest decor in the office, that kind of stuff. You want to find a place that, you know, you're happy in the office and you can safely and effectively treat patients. But, you know, also finding a place, I think that there's enough people, there's enough population, you know, it's not going to be an overserved area. I mean, that was one of the things I was fortunate in. The practice itself was older and the production wasn't great, but the area wasn't oversaturated with OMSs. There was, you know, adequate population. So once I got there and started getting out and marketing and reaching out to referrals, potential referrals, and just kind of looking at insurance options, what insurances made sense to participate with, and, you know, be willing to take emergencies, you know, early on, be willing to take those patients where it's 4:30 and the dentist broke off the tooth, or, you know, you've got, you know, an infection on a Friday, you know, be willing to take those patients does help build goodwill and rapport and, you know, hopefully make a difference in building your practice down the road. And thankfully in my case, you know, we were able to, you know, grow the production in the practice significantly. And then, like I said, about 3 years ago, we built a new office and, you know, we've got more space and been able to have, as far as some of the niceties that, you know, would have liked to have initially, as far as larger surgery rooms and, you know, just a nicer building and more modern, you know, open, nice reception area. But then you get to the point where you're kind of, you know, one of the challenges there is as you grow and grow, trying to balance, you know, you want to be productive and you want to be financially successful, but then not allowing your practice to kind of own you too much. You know, we end up spending too much time there because you're continuing to try to grow and grow. You know, you got to still find that balance for the rest of your life and your family. And that's one of the things now I'm trying to work on doing, trying to work on bringing in an associate, kind of balance that out and continue to grow the practice. So if there's anybody out there that's would be interested in coming to Virginia, to the East Coast, I'd love to hear from you.
Nice. I can put your email in the show notes and people could reach out if they're interested.
Yeah, if there's anybody that it's a great place. I mean, that's the thing about that I've found is a lot of people do love, you know, the idea after residency of, you know, living in a big city. You know, here in the East, it's, you know, maybe Washington, D.C. or Charlotte or Atlanta or places like that. But, you know, it costs a lot more to live there and there's a lot more competition. You know, it's like I talked to oral surgeons in Northern Virginia, and there's a ton more competition there. Everybody, for the number of patients you have compared to the number of dentists and OMSs there are, you know, compared to a small to medium-sized city where there's a lot more opportunity, I think. And it doesn't cost near as much to live.
Looks like a beautiful place. I mean, they're in the kind of the mountainous area of Virginia, right?
Yeah, it's in Southwest Virginia. It's right along the Appalachian Trail. So yeah, it's a great place for hiking, mountain biking, some good lakes nearby. But yeah, it's a nice place, and you can have, and there's different options as far as, you know, there's kind of suburban communities, subdivisions, that kind of things. You can also have some land. I mean, we actually live out and have like 25 acres and have some space and a little pond and some animals
cool.
And things. So there's, you know, there's different options depending on what kind of life path you want as far as outside of work.
All right. Well, we end every podcast with some rapid fire questions. So ready for this. First one is, what is the best book you've read in the past year?
Best book I've read in the past year. I think I listened to a lot of books. Okay. I'll just give you one. This has been the last few months, a book called Outlive. It's about a guy that's a longevity doctor, and he talks about different things to do to kind of live, not just live a long time, but have a healthy life for a long time. So it did give me a lot of thoughts about things, nutrition, exercise-wise, that, you know, I should look at doing if I want to stay active and until my older years.
That's Peter Attia, right? He wrote that book. Yeah. Nice. Okay. What non-oral surgery thing do you do in your daily life that helps you with your kind of daily oral surgery skills? Is there anything out of the office that kind of translates to the things you're doing in the office and helps you out?
I would say having 8 kids definitely helps you be more patient with difficult patients. I mean, that sounds silly, but, you know, and the thing about having 8 kids is they're all different personalities. So as you have teenagers come in, you know, the different personalities that you experience when you're, you know, sedating teenagers, or even that part where you're like initially getting the IV started and working them through their anxiety, or even younger children that just need a couple of teeth out with nitrous, kind of talking them through that. Yeah, I think it really does help, you know, having to deal with all these different personalities at your house. It just gives you more experience.
All right. Listeners, you heard it here first. The importance of having many kids. So get on that, folks. But no, I agree with that. I think just the other day I had a kid in my chair that was flipping out with the IV, and my assistants afterwards, they're like, how are you so calm in those settings? You just don't even act like anything's, you know, happening that's stressful. And that was my answer. You know, having so many kids, I feel like that necessitates you being a more patient, calm person. If not, you'll lose your mind. Okay. Next question is, what forceps do you use to extract tooth number 14?
I honestly just most of the time just go with the upper universal, a 150. I do use upper cow horns sometimes, but most things I just use a 150 and upper universal.
And what about, so do you, same thing for like a number 12 or 13, a premolar?
Yeah, most of the time. I do have some other kind of slightly different serrated specialized forceps that are good for grabbing those kind of broken off premolars that are right at the gum line, but just kind of an average one. I just use a upper universal.
Not the ash, right? Or do you use the ash?
No, I use ash for lower premolars. So kind of mandibular premolar forward, I use ash or forceps for. But most uppers, I just use a 154.
And real quick, when you're extracting thirds, what type of burr do you use for that?
I actually use an 8-round initially. If assuming they're like a full bony or mostly, you know, bony covered thirds, I use an 8-round to actually do a buccal trough and just remove bone around the buccal surface. And then I use a Fisher Burr, you know, kind of 703/560, depending on, you know, where you get it from, to section the tooth.
Sounds good. Pretty similar for me. I use the 703 or 702 as well. Okay, next question. Best movie or TV series you've watched recently?
Best movie or TV series? I'm trying to think. I don't watch a ton of movies. Let's see. You know what was a good movie I watched recently? I watched this on, so we flew back. I flew out to Utah a few weeks ago for a ski trip, and I was watching movies on the plane. And this was a movie that was really old. I hadn't seen it in many years, and I watched it. It was really fun. It was The Hunt for Red October. And then my son, who's 14, actually, he's really into military stuff, so he watched it too, and he thought it was really cool. But yeah, it was just an old movie that I hadn't seen in really many years, and it was fun to watch it. And it was pretty fun. So yeah, I guess that would be a one that I've seen recently that was pretty fun.
Okay, sounds good. Submarine movie, right?
Yeah, Sean Connery and Jack Ryan. Back when Jack Ryan, I don't remember who, it was like Alec Baldwin, I think. I know later in the Jack Ryan movies, it was Harrison Ford, but this one, I think it was Alec Baldwin. But anyway.
How about favorite stand-up comedian? Do you listen to comedians at all or watch them?
I don't really listen to a lot of comedians. I'm trying to think. Favorite stand-up comedian. Years ago, we went to Brian Regan.
Oh yeah, love him.
One of his shows, that was pretty fun. I'll say that. Like I said, it's not something I listen to a lot. But yeah, I mean, that was one we went to quite a few years ago that was pretty fun. So I'll say that. Nice.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, he's fantastic. My wife and I just recently saw Jerry Seinfeld. He came to Denver, so that was awesome to see him. He's great.
No, I actually had that experience. So when we were in Salt Lake, when we flew in there to go skiing, we were renting cars. And anyway, we got there and they're like, oh, we know you reserved a 7-passenger SUV or a couple ones in our case, but we don't have any of those in stock. So it just reminded me of the old Seinfeld episode where they go to rent the car and they're like, you took the reservation. Now you just need to hold the reservation. You know, it was like the idea that, anyway, you know, you had the car reserved and they knew that, but they just decided not to have any of those cars in stock when you showed up.
Yeah, anyway. So frustrating. Gosh, yeah, I forgot about that because there's 8 people in our family and it's like there's so few cars that fit us all. I mean, you have a 12-passenger van or what do you use when you have more than 8 people?
We have a 12-passenger van that we drive, but usually when we go on trips, it depends on what we're doing. If it's a summertime trip, the reason I differentiate this is it has to do with weather. We'll usually just rent like a 15-passenger van. If we're going skiing and we're concerned about the road conditions, like usually once a year we go out west to go skiing, we'll usually just rent 2 like 7-passenger SUVs just because we want something with all-wheel drive. I mean, because like we were up at Alton Snowbird in Utah, and the roads were fine when we went up there. But then as we were, you know, finishing up skiing on Friday and driving back down, they had gotten 1 foot of snow that day. And so the canyon was a mess. So if you didn't have anything that was 4-wheel drive, all wheel drive, it would have been a disaster.
Well, the trials of trying to transport a large family. Oh, if you're looking for any stand-up comedians, have you heard Nate Bargatze? There's this really hilarious Southern guy, Dusty Slay, some pretty funny guys. Anyways, that's all on Netflix. Okay, last question. What is your favorite quote? Do you have, sometimes this one's hard to think of off the cuff, but do you have a favorite quote or I don't know, something that you frequently go back to? Maybe something you tell your kids when they're mouthing off to you and you need to whip them into shape.
This is like a version of a line from Braveheart. I don't know if it's the exact quote, but there's like a part where, you know, talking to them about fighting versus running because they're outnumbered. And he basically says, yes, run and we'll live, fight and we may die. But he basically says, you know, lying in your beds many years from now, would you give all the days from that day to this for just one chance to tell your enemies that they can I think they says you can take our lives, but they can't take our freedom. But anyway, but kind of the way, I don't remember exactly if this particular line is in there, but the what we've kind of developed as our family quote is all men die, but not all men truly live. And that's, I mean, and you know, I'm not trying to tell my kids they should do anything too stupid and get themselves killed. But the idea is that, you know, ultimately everybody's going to die. You know, it's like I have people talk about risk, you know, and what's risk. And I'm like, yeah, you could be driving home and run over by a truck. You could, you know, an asteroid could fall out of the sky and crush you. You know, the point is life is full of risk. And if you spend too much time avoiding risk in your life, you're going to get to where you're old and you're never going to have actually lived. So anyway, so that's our favorite quote is all men die, but not all men truly live.
Love that. That's a good quote. So make the most of the time you have, you know, follow your passion, do that stuff. I like that. It's a good quote. All right, Sam. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this podcast episode with us. If you're good with it, I could put, you know, your email or some contact info in the show notes. That way, listeners could reach out to you if they have
questions. I'd love that. Like I said, if there's anybody out there looking for a practice opportunity and think, you know, you this area of the country would enjoy, I'd love to talk to you. I think you'd like it, and we definitely could. We're looking to grow and definitely have some excess capacity and patience that we could share. So
awesome. Sounds good. Well, let's keep in touch, and thanks again for doing this.
Well, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Talk to you later. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.